Welcome back. This is your warm day. My name is Sharon and I serve the village's education lead. And I'd like to welcome back Jason Rose. Western Bureau Chief of Kirk NPR and National Religion Editor. Perfect. And today's topic is, see, that's what I forgot. Encountering conflict. It's been really fun to be in the listening room, so thank you.
Yes. So thank you all for coming to the listening room. This is our final session. In the final session, I've learned how to use the microphone. The problem was this. I was using a microphone designed for women, and this is a microphone designed for men. Now, this is not a sexist thing. It's the way that men's shirts button and the way that women's shirts button, it's the other way. And so that other one was sort of constantly rubbing against the way that my shirt buttoned. I didn't know that you could just flip it. Well, welcome back to the listening room. This session is on conflict, and I called it Encountering Conflict. Now, I think that probably all of you took some kind of introduction to literature class in high school or college where you learned the different kinds of conflict. So can anybody name some of those types of conflict? I'll name the one that is the most common. It's like person versus person. That's the one that we always often think about. Yes? Right, person versus environment, setting, something like that, yes? Okay, another one?
Person versus self.
Person versus self, okay. Person versus society. There are lots of different types of conflicts. I think that quite often when we think of conflicts, we think of person versus person or institution versus institution or party versus party. But I've picked a few pieces that try to illustrate different kinds of conflict. Now here's a question, maybe this is a good room to ask this question to. Do all conflicts need to be resolved?
No.
Good, right answer. I think that sometimes the criticism that journalists get for reporting on conflict is that we report on them as if some side is going to win at some point.
Or should
win at some point. And some of the pieces that I'm playing for you today are not about one side triumphing over the other, especially when you start to think about things like person versus self. Well, how do you triumph in that way? Or society versus society leads to constant war. So maybe there are other ways to think about conflict. So all of the conflicts that I'm going to play for you today, and these pieces, I should say, are slightly, well, the first piece isn't, but the other pieces are slightly longer. They're about 7 to 8 minutes long. So we might go slightly over five, but I hear that the kitchen likes that to stagger us into dinner. So let's start with this piece. I have this fear that, like, the person in this piece might be in this room because she sounds like a very Holden-esque person. So if that's the case, I apologize.
Identify with any religion. The series is called Losing Our Religion, and it's time now to meet a couple for whom this subject is extremely personal. One partner has faith, and the other does not. Dina Pritchett reports.
Maria Pyre and Mike Bixby are one of those couples that just seem made for each other. They hold hands when they sit and talk. They're happy to spend the morning cooking brunch with their kids and stepkids in their Southern Washington home. Mike and Maria have actually known each other since they were young, but only got married a few years ago, and it just hadn't been the right time until it was.
She had Facebook with me and asked if I remembered her, and then it just went from there.
But there's one big issue where they do not see eye to eye. Maria is Lutheran. Her father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were all pastors. She's an assisting minister. And Mike is an atheist.
I do not believe that there is any sort of a higher power. I've made several attempts to go back and have faith, and it just doesn't work. It's not an open question for me anymore.
I would really like it if he could feel God's love the way I do. And it's one of those very few places where I feel like I can say, I hear you, I understand what you're saying, I love you, and I think that there may be more to it.
They do find ways to come together. Mike even goes along to church every now and then.
I heard a lot from Marie, you know, you're very spiritual in this way, and you're very spiritual in that way. And a couple days ago, I kind of joked with her that that is a very secular humanist attitude. That shows a lot of growth, a lot of not faith or whatever.
Mike and Maria may disagree about faith, but they share common values, even in their vocations. She's an oncology nurse, and he teaches fourth grade.
Mike works with kids that come from really hard places. And I work with people that are dying of cancer and living with cancer. And for me to do that as a Christian person, for Mike to do that as an atheist, wouldn't look a whole lot different if either one of us were the other.
Maria's faith plays a role in making her the person that I love, and I'm good with that. I think we're both the people we are because of her faith, because of my lack of faith, and I don't want to change that.
In the past, couples like this often would make a change. Whichever person had the stronger conviction would set the terms. But these days, people are redrawing the lines.
These families are doing something different, and they're making their own choices.
That's Erica Saman. She teaches religion at Georgetown University and studies interfaith relationships. And she sees couples find common ground on love, ethics, even spirituality, while maintaining very different religious identities.
What it's doing is it's mixing up, confusing, and blurring these ideas of religion and community and affiliation and ritual and faith.
Saman says that couples who do it successfully use the tools you might expect.
They listen and they talk and they try and understand one another. A number of them mention humor. You could probably take that list of advice that they would give and use it for any situation, whether it's religion or just raising children or getting along in the world.
Because Mike and Maria got together just a few years ago, they didn't have to hammer out a compromise on the kids. Hers are being raised Lutheran, his don't go to church. But these tools, communication, humor, compassion, help them work through their differences on other aspects of faith. And it's work they're grateful for.
I mean, it's not a what should we have for dinner kind of question, you know, it's a this matters. Dinner matters too, often a lot, but we don't fight about dinner. And we don't fight about this. It has very much helped me clarify what's true for me.
If I was a different type of non-believer and Maria was a different type of believer, then that would be a very different question.
I can love you and think you're wrong, and you can love me and think I'm wrong. So I appreciate this opportunity to grapple with it, and I appreciate you for being the one I get to grapple with it. But,
and grappling together for Mike Bixby and Maria Pyer looks a lot like love. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
Unusual.
I'm sorry. Did you say
it was an unusual case?
It's an unusual case, you think?
And I thought it sounded like my family.
Yeah, it sounded like my family too.
Oh, you did. Well, what do you think of that conflict? Is it a conflict that should be resolved? They don't seem to think so.
It sounds like it is resolved.
Ah,
yeah, there you go.
You can live with the tension.
Yeah.
Right. And it sounds like some of that tension gives the gives you know life to their relationship. It doesn't need to be all one thing.
What I wonder is about the kids at the table. These have to go to church and these don't. Mommy, how come I have to go to boring Sunday school?
She doesn't.
Again, this is almost always my response to why wasn't this voice in it. If we'd had a couple more minutes, I would have loved to tell that story. I think that would be a great story to tell. Yes?
I think people normally avoid conflict. And I'm thinking of a choir I was in, another group I was in. People want to get along, and they don't want to go to conflict. Or they exit from the group and find a place where the people want to argue or whatever. But normally, I think they generally don't want to. I just want to talk a little bit further. I was at a church meeting one time where a group of Palestinians and Israelis were both there. And they're both very intense. It didn't come to blows. It could have very easily have come to blows. But the pastor was a very, very skillful guy. He was able to mediate between them so there was some sort of dialogue. But that was very unusual.
Yeah. I mean, I think that some people avoid conflict, some people engage in conflict, and then some people seek out conflict. And I think, I mean, I find this for myself, I am different in different situations. I am a big fan of certain kinds of conflict and like to pick at the scab of certain issues. And in other ones, I avoid the conflict. And in other ones, I really like to engage it in a sort of more meaningful way. And I think it's interesting for us to think about, I don't know that any one person is any one of those ways, but we all, on different issues, may operate in one of those several ways toward conflicts. What was the most surprising thing you heard in this story?
Up here?
Yes.
Not surprising. I think it's very common, but almost as though, you know, you happen to have this idea, I happen to have this one, without investigating, looking into things. You know, the Christian faith is historic, and that's the way to pursue this, to dig in and see what's behind it. Mm-hmm. Didn't sense any of that whatsoever with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he had thought about it. I just think not everybody wants to investigate it. It just wasn't an important thing for him to do, and she seems to be okay with that. Did somebody over here have a hand up? Yes.
I was going to say that, yeah, I felt like the topic was just that they found this way to live together with a different point of view, but mm-hmm. you really didn't know what their points of view were, other than the labeling of it. But, you know, I mean, because I didn't know what faith, that word faith, meant to her, or we knew that they shared spiritual values and so, you know, some things, but and we maybe knew a little more from him, just that, well, he tried faith and it sort of didn't work for him, or, you know, but it, you know, in a short piece like that, it wouldn't have been really time to go into that, but it seemed at a level up here about these are two people that are dealing with, you know, different understandings or different points of view, but you don't really get into the substance. I mean, I wanted to, like, you know, argue with him or something, or you know, or argue with him, or ask him a question. You know, ask him a question, like, well, what do you think it is? And I wonder if she would say that to him, or what he would say mm-hmm. to her. And because it sounded to me, my suspicion was it was like faith as doctrine or something. You know, like.
Yeah,
anyway,
I mean,
it left me sort of feeling a little unsatisfied.
And I think we do get into later in the piece, the you know, especially when she starts talking about their work and their vocations in the world,
right.
That I think that they do have a different. I mean, they probably do not discuss, you know, the doctrines of the Trinity or something, which is also the least interesting thing ever to discuss. So, you know, I actually think that a lot of, especially if you've got two different religions or if you have a religious person and a non-religious person, you come to a detente about, like, what are you going to argue about? And are you, like, those things just probably aren't important to them. What are important to them are the things that they did bring up. Yes, over here.
Push that there was a right or wrong. You know, you had to be saved, or, you know, Christianity is the road. You know, I think all three of the monotheistic religions have that somewhere, and a lot of us are raised, whereas I think if this had been a Buddhist and a Hindu, or a Baha'i and a more agnostic,
right.
You know, it probably wouldn't have even been an interesting article, because their philosophy is much more whatever mm-hmm. works for you.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
It's interesting for me. I would want to know how she came by her faith other than her lineage.
Mm-hmm.
She talked about her father, right. Grandfather, great-grandfather being ministers. It's almost as if that was a foregone conclusion
right.
that she inherited. Her faith or whatever
right.
it is that she has.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But they have values that transcend
right.
their beliefs.
Right. I think, as someone who was raised in ambient Lutheranism and has existed in ambient Lutheranism for a long time, I don't know that I would talk about it very much if I weren't actually like doing things like this, or you know, taking religion, religion major in college, so like you know, doing it that way. But I know, I think I know a lot of people, probably not the kind of people who come to Holden Village, but who just sort of they're like sort of ambient Lutherans, like or ambient Methodists. They, it's what they were raised, it's what they do, and they don't really need to constantly be justifying it to other people. It's just the thing that they do. Yes. Right, There are two moments, you know, this is a piece that doesn't have a lot of scene in it, and we talked about setting a sense of place earlier in the week. But there are two moments of sound that isn't people talking in the story that I think are important to think about. You hear them laugh several times, in the beginning and at the end, but the most telling thing, and Dina, who's an amazing reporter, and I work with her all the time. She's in Portland, so you might get to hear her locally in Portland if you're from there. There's that sigh that he gives when you hear you hear Dina ask a question, and then he just goes, and you want to leave that in because that is in of itself. That I think that sigh speaks for many things. And I wanted it to be left open to interpretation. I didn't want like a big old gloss right after that sigh. He then starts talking, and I think he's glossing his own sigh, but I thought it was best for him to do that and not us. Well, I want to play several other pieces, so let's... I'm going to end with the one that's going to make you cry. So we're going to do these that aren't going to make you cry now. These are two companion pieces. They're a little long. Each is 7 minutes long. Let's say between the two, we can talk for maybe just like a minute or two, but then I want you to hear the next one. These aired on Morning Edition and All Things Considered on the same day. One aired in the morning and one aired in the afternoon. That is not necessarily the most ideal way to tell a full story because some people will hear the first one and not the second one. Some people will hear the second one but not the first one. But each one we tried to make stand as much alone as you could. We did tell people at the end of the first one that there was more on this later this afternoon. And I think we told people in the second one that if they wanted to hear the first piece, they could come to the website and listen to it both. The trick with these is that they're airing during drive time news magazines, and people use those. Very few people like will sit and listen to something that's 20 or 30 minutes long, or even 12 or 13 minutes long, because they're coming in and out of their cars, in and out of the bathroom, walking the dog, whatever. So you have to try to grab their attention. So this finally, you're going to get to hear a piece from Tom Jalton, who's a religion correspondent whom I work with. Quite a lot. And we'll start it.
In the last few months, several states, mostly in the South, have considered laws meant to uphold religious liberty. Those proposals have come in response to complaints from conservative Christians who say they're being forced to accept ideas about gender that conflict with their religious beliefs. To support that position, they cite the Bible. But their arguments are being challenged by changing views in society. From Louisville, Kentucky, here's NPR's Tom Jalton.
About 10,000 evangelicals filled a basketball arena in Louisville last month. It was a Together for the Gospel conference.
But thanks be to God, we're here together.
Albert Moeller, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, co-founded the Gospel Conference. It's associated with the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest of the Protestant denominations in America, the denominations that trace their history to Martin Luther's revolt against church evils in his time.
We are here because we believe it was the Protestant Reformation, and we are here to say we're still at it.
Under Moeller's theological leadership, Southern Baptists are standing up against practices they consider immoral.
Our theme for this year is We Protest, which you might say putting the protest back in Protestantism.
The conference attendees were mostly men, young men, beginning their careers as church pastors. Under Southern Baptist doctrine, only men can be pastors. On gender roles and on matters of sex, marriage, and family, Southern Baptists hold to a conservative position. The broader society is leaving them behind, and
and Mueller knows it, we are on the losing side of a massive change that's not going to be reversed in all likelihood in our lifetimes. Instead, we've got to shift to asking how we're going to live faithfully in a world in which we're going to be a moral exception to the way the rest of the society is ordered. Dr. Mueller wants his fellow Baptists to take what he considers a biblical stand against such things as no-fault divorce, extramarital sex, transgenderism, and gay marriage. And though the rest of America may be willing to accommodate those practices, Mueller's views resonated at the Gospel Conference in Louisville. Joshua Vandermeer is a student at the Southern Baptist Seminary preparing to be a pastor.
The Bible makes claims about what is right and wrong, and those claims are often at odds with what everyday people believe. And so Christians are called to protest and to witness to what the Bible claims to be right and wrong.
But an insistence on strict Bible-based standards of morality excludes some people. They either leave the church altogether or go elsewhere for guidance.
And now let's take some time to pray for this space.
Pastor Matt Johnson grew up as a Southern Baptist, but his current church in Southwest Louisville, Ridgewood Baptist, has gradually softened its positions.
And now let's offer words of hope, hope for the future, of what could happen here, who could come here and find a place to belong.
Ridgewood now welcomes those who may feel out of place elsewhere, those whose marriages have ended, or gay people. Janelle Perry is the youth director.
We're not the same Ridgewood that we were years ago. It's totally different. Some people are taken aback by that. Women deacons, and we'll let most anybody attend. Anybody wants to come. We're just open-armed.
It's not that Ridgewood Baptist caters to liberals. This part of Louisville, Pastor Johnson says, is home to a working-class population that feels increasingly disenfranchised.
I think actually this community, it represents in some ways the new face of poverty. It doesn't look like a poor neighborhood, but it's people that are really living paycheck to paycheck.
Economic stress is hard on people and hard on marriages. Estelle Power joined Ridgewood with her husband years ago, then left the church for a while. Eventually she came back. After going through a devastating divorce, she needed the kind of comforting environment that Ridgewood offered.
I don't know what I would have done without this church. I really don't. I guess because I had felt like I was the only person in the world that was going through a divorce. And if it had not been for that, I don't know what I would have done.
At Ridgewood, she found others whose lives didn't necessarily fit a church ideal. She can relate because of her own experience.
I've made some friends just saying hello and somebody would say, well, you're so kind, you know, you're so kind. And said, no, I'm just who I am, you know. But I do think that it makes you a little more humble when you go through something.
All her life, she had heard bad things about women who were divorced. Now she's less inclined to judge. Pastor Johnson says it's people like Estelle Powers his church can serve, people who might not feel comfortable in a stricter congregation.
There are people who have stopped going to church because they think that all that church is a place where you're being condemned and where you're just told this is what you have to think. And, you know, I think we have a church, a really special place here.
Ridgewood is one of the congregations that broke away from the Southern Baptist Convention about 25 years ago over the role of women. Southern Baptists say men and women complement each other but are not interchangeable, which is why they don't allow women to serve as pastors or even as deacons. At the Southern Baptist Seminary, Dr. Albert Mueller says the church position may seem outdated, but comes straight from the Bible. It's an entire pattern of complementarity that we see woven throughout the account of Scripture from Genesis 1, 26 to 28, all the way to the book of Revelation. And so it's not a minor matter to suggest that the church can somehow just update its understanding of gender. This is a challenging time for Baptists of all views. Many yearn for the certainty they find in a strict reading of the Bible. More than 15 million Americans attend Southern Baptist churches. But can they maintain their strong position indefinitely with the culture changing around them? Down at Ridgewood Baptist, Pastor Johnson and his congregants hope their more inclusive approach will help them grow, but their numbers are still small. Some of those who have soured on the Southern Baptist approach now reject church altogether. And from the outside, Ridgewood looks like all the other Baptist churches in Louisville. That fact could have kept Nick Wilson from joining had he not heard it was a welcoming church.
Driving by, seeing Ridgewood Baptist Church, I would not stop. I would just assume
that I already know what's going on inside those doors and I'm not welcome or I don't want to be part of it, and would go on.
Why would Nick Wilson think he'd be unwelcome at a church like Ridgewood? Because he's an openly gay man. Later today, on All Things Considered, his story, being Baptist and gay. Tom Jelton, NPR News.
Christians have become far more accepting of LGBT people and same-sex marriage. Conservative evangelicals remain opposed to such relationships, but by an ever smaller margin. Now, even as some states enact laws allowing religious objections to same-sex unions, the issue is a subject of open debate within the evangelical world. From Louisville, Kentucky, NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
In the South, preaching is a calling, and it often runs in families, like it did for Nick Wilson growing up in rural Kentucky.
Two great-grandfathers were Southern Baptist preachers, and one grandfather was a pastor. Father's retired pastor, brother's a pastor. We were always in church.
With lots of gospel music, Appalachian. Nick learned to play the piano by ear as a young boy. He accompanied the choir in his father's churches. An old piano sits just inside the front door in his little one-bedroom house in Louisville, and he plays it daily. But Nick Wilson was called to preach in his own church. After college, he enrolled at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, but no congregation would ordain him. They all wanted a model family man, and Nick Wilson didn't fit the bill.
First off, I'm single. That's a problem. They really want you to be married. But then if you throw in gay, then it's over with.
Wilson says he knew from the time he was 6 or 7 that he was different. In time, he became open about his sexuality, even taking his boyfriend to church. In the Southern Baptist world, that disqualified him.
The Apostle Paul, very explicitly in 1 Corinthians, says that those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of God.
Albert Moeller is president of the Southern Baptist Seminary.
Now, that means that a biblical Christian can't accept the idea of a Christian who persists in that kind of sin, because scripture nullifies that possibility.
At one time, Moeller advocated therapy for LGBT people to get them to change their sexual orientation. He now thinks same-sex attraction may be involuntary. Still, he says those who feel it should not act on it. Better to remain celibate. He also rejects same-sex marriage.
If you can change the way a society or civilization defines itself, at the most molecular level, at marriage and family, and if you can redefine sexual mores pervasively, you will have changed the society utterly.
This is the Southern Baptist view, and the view of conservative Christians generally. Moeller is an intellectual leader in the evangelical world. Not surprisingly, as an evangelical, Nick Wilson has long struggled with being gay.
It didn't take long to realize that that was not approved of, because I heard my father preach about it. I mean, I have been to the point of suicide over trying to not be gay, because I felt early on called to the ministry, but then gay, Christian, in the world I grew up in, that didn't go together. You had to be one or the other. And God didn't take it away, the calling or the gay.
But then a few years ago, Wilson found a Baptist church with an especially open attitude. Ridgewood Baptist Church in a working-class Louisville neighborhood is a small congregation not affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention. Its pastor, Matt Johnson, now 36, was raised and schooled in the Southern Baptist tradition with views typical for his time and place.
Homosexuality is wrong, and that's very clear in the Bible. So, you know, that's kind of the end of the discussion.
But Johnson went to a moderate divinity school, and his views on homosexuality softened after his experience there among some gay Christians.
People who are there because they want to be ministers, and whose faith was very challenging to me, and who were just deeply committed Christians and deeply committed to their faith, and who also were gay.
After a careful study of scripture, he eventually concluded that biblical references to homosexual activity were not as clear-cut as he originally thought, but it was his encounter with gay ministry students that made the big difference.
And it was, golly, I see the Holy Spirit working in these people's lives. Who am I to say that they are not Christians or that they are somehow lost or wrong. I don't feel like my faith is nearly as strong as theirs. I'm challenged and humbled by that.
Pastor Johnson brought those views to Ridgewood. Homosexuality was not itself a big issue there. The congregation did already have a reputation for openness, however. Nick Wilson, uncomfortable elsewhere as a gay man, was welcome there. Last month, at the age of 51, he was ordained at Ridgewood as a Baptist minister. The church's gay-friendly reputation has costed a few members, but most have taken it in stride, if they've even paid attention. For Sarah Thurman and other members of her youth group at Ridgewood, it's a total non-issue, even in a community where LGBT rights are not well established.
A lot of the people I end up stuck around find it hard to believe. Like, when I say that we have a gay member in our church, they just don't understand how we allow that. So I was like, well, what do you mean? How do we allow that? They walk through the door.
Young people in general are much more likely to support same-sex relationships, but it is not universal. The men who choose to attend the Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville do so knowing their church's position. Matt Mihalik, 28, preparing to be a pastor, says if a young man were to come to him and confide that he's gay, he'd advise him to embrace God's view of sexuality alone.
He should, again, refrain from sexual activity until he's married. And to a woman, yeah, marriage between one man and one woman.
But he would have to refrain from homosexual activity for the rest of his life, basically.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Dr. Moeller, the seminary president, says he's often asked whether he and other conservative evangelicals are obsessed with issues of sexuality, given all the evils they could focus on. He defends the emphasis.
The sexual revolution is undergirded by a vast change in the moral thinking, the moral intuitions of Americans. And the reason why we can't drop this is because we do believe it matters to salvation and eternity.
Other Christian thinkers take a more nuanced view of sexual ethics, and for gay people like Nick Wilson, committed to their Christian faith but unwilling to remain celibate their entire lives, the Southern Baptist approach just isn't realistic.
I was raised a Southern Baptist to be virgin until you marry, because sex is just bad, bad, bad.
Is there such a thing as sexual sin?
Well, I definitely think there can be, depending on how sex is used, or how somebody is literally used in sex. That can be sinful if you're not honoring that other person and just using them as an object for your gratification. I think that's sinful.
Nick Wilson is a Baptist, and there's one hymn in particular that identifies his faith tradition. It's one all Baptists recognize as their own, and one Wilson has played hundreds of times.
Just as I am.
For a gay man, the words, just as I am, has special meaning. Playing it at home, Wilson says he often tears up. But the hymn is also about repentance. Born-again Christians turn away from their sins, from drink, from drugs, from promiscuity, and they seek forgiveness. The question is, what does that mean for a born-again gay man? Nick Wilson acknowledges that he too is a sinner, but not because of his sexual orientation, nor because of his hope that someday he too will marry. Tom Jelton, NPR News, Louisville.
What do you think of this story? Mike?
Jason, two brief comments. One, I discovered at 11 or 12 that I thought I was bi, but I didn't even know the word for it. And I remember hearing that hymn when I was going forward at a Billy Graham rally in New York and feeling very good, but also not clear whether it applied to what I just said earlier. The other comment is the incredible skill, genius, and risk-taking involved in editing between the voice of the newsman or news person and the voices that we want to hear more of. And I thought this was an example of the skill being used really, really well.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I didn't mean it. That's what I heard.
Yeah, Tom is an amazing reporter. I mean, he's covered.
But there was editing involved, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's my job. But Tom is an incredible reporter, and, you know, he. This is an interesting story because I'm really tired of this story personally. Like, I feel like I have heard it 1,000 different times. But Tom wanted to tell it through evangelicals and through the Southern Baptist Convention, and that's why I thought it was okay, and it's why I okayed this story. Because I think we've all heard this story played out 1,000,000,000,000 times in among Methodists and Lutherans and Episcopalians, especially Episcopalians, and the UCC and Presbyterians. But they're all moving in one direction. This is a kind of, the SBC is moving in a different direction, perhaps. And I think one of the things this story does is actually say, well, it seems to be polarizing within it, that its own denomination. Although just 2 or 3 weeks ago when they had their annual conference, they did, well, they rejected white nationalism, but they also then said that, like, substitutionary atonement is the only way to understand atonement. So.
Can you define evangelicals and I mean, for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, but I don't really feel part of the evangelicals in the piece. And is it the media that created the word evangelicals? And who are they and who are we?
That's a many, many semester course. As I understand, so evangelicals call themselves that. I mean, conservative Christian evangelicals. And I think in this piece, we tried to make it really clear that we were talking about a specific kind of conservative evangelical. I have my own opinions about why the ELCA has an E in it, but somebody who's better than I am can explain why the word evangelical appears in there. The German church is called the Evangelische Church. It basically means not Catholic in Germany, but here it means something else, and I think it's a terrible name, and I would have changed the name, but there are people who wanted to hang on to that, so they did. that's my take on it. Yes?
This is really simplified, but I've heard that there were a number of people who were responsible for the naming who thought they could the term evangelical.
Right. That sounds like hubris to me, but...
Well, for most of us, it certainly does to me, too. Yeah. I just cringe as a pastor when they chose that.
Yeah.
And I think it was a mistake. I think we're starting to see that because you can't do it in our climate. Mm-hmm. We understand evangelical very differently.
Right. My own synod in Southwest California uses EV period, and so that you can think whatever you want, the evolving, I don't know.
My understanding of the reasoning behind it or the justification for it was the word alone idea in Luther's theology, that we understand that our faith comes by hearing the word of God. And the evangelical, the Greek word evangelion, is the word for gospel. Mm-hmm.
I think that there are great reasons. I actually think, though, that from a marketing point of view, it didn't actually work the way it was supposed to. But I don't want to get distracted by, you know, naming problems in the ELCA. That's not what this piece is about at all. It is, just to get back to your question, the word evangelical is not a creation of the media. It is what evangelicals call themselves, sort of the mid-century group of Americans who wanted to return back to... what they think of as biblical, Bible-based ideas. I have to say, like, I was almost going to play a piece for you today that ended up not playing. We did right after the refugee ban was announced, as I mentioned earlier today, Tom did a story, and we had Franklin Graham in it saying, immigration and refugee issues are not Bible issues, which I think is shocking. Like, it's so shocking to me because I can name way more Bible verses about immigration and refugees than I can about sexuality. Other thoughts on these pieces? How what we tried to do is in this piece is show a number of kinds of conflict, both person versus self conflict with the man we sort of profile in the second half. The church is in the SBC is in conflict with itself in certain ways. The denomination, this Ridgewood Baptist, sort of is this group that broke away about 25 years ago, still very Baptist, and as we say in the piece, would not call itself progressive in many ways. But I mean, I think it's in the first piece. It's in the second piece. I think the fact that divorce became like part of the story was interesting to me, and how like, it would not occur to me that that would be a problem. I'm not divorced, so I don't know, but it was shocking to me that there was so much angst in that woman's voice and story around divorce, which it's probably way more like interesting to hear that. I was way more interested in that part of the conflict than in the gay stuff, which I feel like I've just like reported on so much, and I haven't reported on divorce very much. Yes?
I appreciated how much the story gave to Moeller, because there was enough that you heard him enough that you really could understand his point of view. It wasn't just and I say that as a person that has a really different point of view, but I felt like I could sort of empathize with him some, and that's unusual for me to empathize with someone like that, and it was partly I could see it from his point of view, and it was only because there was enough. The seminarian didn't get as much time, and that was kind of more of a more stereotypical kind of response. But I like that Moeller got enough airtime that you could sort of mull it over.
Yeah, we wanted to give him significant time to make his case, so that people can decide. Okay, this is what they say. We're not trying to caricature what he says. We're trying to let him have his say in the piece as well.
It certainly didn't end anything. I mean, it didn't. It didn't go to a place where I said, "Oh, that's the sort of conclusion."
Right.
There's more coming.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we don't resolve much in the story, but I don't think that the story is much resolved. I think the man who, like, we sort of reveal. Actually, thinking back on this structurally, I think I may have wanted to reveal that he was ordained at the very end, that he had been recently ordained as a Baptist minister, not a Southern Baptist minister. But I may have moved that in the story later, just for dramatic effect. We could have put it elsewhere in the story, but that is some resolution. I also really like the section that we included with Tom. You hear Tom asking the question of him, is there such a thing as sexual sin? And I think he does a really nice job of describing that. I don't think that the Southern Baptists in the first part of the piece would disagree with that. I think they would add other things onto it. What's interesting to me about that is that it feels like some of you have probably heard about this book called The Benedict Option, which seems to be getting way more ink spilled over it than it should, similar to Hillbilly Elegy, which are okay but not great books. I just think that they've got great PR machines behind them. I think it's interesting when, I think that a lot of mainline Protestant denominations think of themselves as like being this small Christian body in conflict with values in the larger society. And it's interesting to me that the values that I sometimes think that group feels it's in conflict with are the values of the Southern Baptists, who also now feel like they are a small group of Christians whose values are in conflict with the larger society. There's this mythical larger society out there that is made up of, both of those groups plus a lot of others. I did play a Catholic piece. Unfortunately, it was all about sex abuse earlier today. But I think that it is interesting. I mean, the Benedict Option. We did a story about the Benedict Option, like people who go and isolate themselves and create very small, fairly isolated Catholic communities earlier this year. So maybe next time I do this, I will include that in this story. That would be a theme for a whole other session about like church versus larger society, when every church thinks it's against a larger society, but nobody knows what that society is.
Have you had many stories about non-denominational versus denominational? What's funny to me is that people, when I mention that non-denominational churches are often much more conservative than they go, what? And I mean, that's like news. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the perception of people who are maybe not, you know, they think that non-denominational churches are more open and more, and that just really is interesting to me because I wonder what the demographic is of people who are involved in mainline churches numbers versus the big mega non-denominational churches.
Right. I don't know. I'm sure that the Pew Center for Religion and Public Life has or will be studying that because it is an increasingly large concern in America. The trick about reporting on non-denominational congregations, in part because they are so, each one is its own thing, it might feel like you're reporting on this unicorn and that unicorn, whereas reporting on like Catholicism or Lutheranism or Southern Baptists, you know you're at least addressing a critical mass of people. So I think it can be a little tricky reporting on non-denominational groups. So is this, here's something that I think about this piece. My trouble with this piece is that it's, to me, incredibly unsatisfying in many ways, but it is also incredibly satisfying in many ways. And I wonder if that has to do with, you know, my own beliefs, or just as a listener who hadn't, I spent like, you know, weeks and weeks working on these pieces. Did the story work for you?
I have so much to say. I'm going to condense it. I'm going to edit it in my head. But I love, and this is why I love a good sermon, or what draws me to a good sermon, is when you're left with things to unpack or talk about, or you want to call your friend and you're like, oh my gosh, I don't even know what I think about this. I don't even know, whatever. And I feel like both these pieces, they had so much, there was no resolution, or there was no, there's a lot of questions and a lot of things. The other part is we go to a Baptist church, and my husband went to a Baptist seminary, and yet we're not Southern Baptists, but there's a little bit of Baptist, is this. So I think there's some unpacking in terms of, all Southern Baptist churches aren't the same. All Baptist churches aren't the same,
right.
And it's, you know, all non-denominational churches aren't
right.
the same. But my question for you is how. So I love that's what I love. I love that when you can wrestle with those questions. But is that part of the objective sometimes when you edit? Is to sort of leave things.
I think you have to give people some kind of emotional resolution, but I don't think you need to resolve everything.
Mm-hmm. So the balance.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this story we resolve certain things and we let other tensions sit there. I don't want everything to end in open conflict. We could have just not said the things that are resolved in the story, or we could have tried to tie everything up. I think that would have felt forced if we tried to tie everything up in the story. I want to play one more piece for you and have time to discuss it afterwards. Again, earlier today I said that I am somewhat reluctant to play pieces where I was the reporter because I don't like sitting around hearing my own voice, but this is one of my favorite pieces I've ever produced, and I wanted to share it with you. It is about lots of different kinds. Well, it is about one very specific kind of conflict, but I think this crowd, this room will appreciate it. And then we'll talk for about 5 or 6 minutes afterwards.
From the first time it happened, Joseph realized something was seriously wrong with Milford, his wife of almost 60 years.
She would awake during the middle of the night, get out of bed, and go running out the front door down the street. And I'd have to go running after her to retrieve.
Those nights, in pajama bottoms and a nightgown, Joseph would take Mildred's hand and walk her back home. Shortly thereafter, doctors diagnosed Mildred with dementia. In the following months, caring for Mildred began to take its toll on Joseph.
The feeding and the clothes and the washing and bathing, it was too much for me to handle, and I wasn't able to hire anybody to help.
Joseph talked with his children about what to do. He spoke with his pastors as well.
They helped me make the decision. It's a very difficult decision to make. I did a lot of prayer.
Joseph and Mildred are lifelong Presbyterians, so when he decided to move her to the Presbyterian home's memory care unit, it was in part because he knew they could worship together there. Still, he had no idea their spiritual life would eventually play a role in their ability to connect to one another, despite Mildred's dementia. Janet Aldrich leads this worship service in the 80-person memory care unit at Presbyterian Homes in Evanston, where Mildred now lives. Aldrich has been a chaplain here for more than a decade, and it was during worship services like this one that she began to notice something remarkable.
A lot of it is just about reaching back to the most deep set of memories, because those last almost throughout the lifetime.
Here's what Aldrich sees. When the song and scripture begin, many of those suffering from dementia sit unresponsive, some with their heads slumped against their chests. Mildred is here too, in her wheelchair, fiddling with a piece of paper. But during the 20-minute service, many of these residents lift their eyes and start to sing. Children's names remember the words to these familiar hymns. They recite the Lord's Prayer and other well-known parts of worship. Aldrich calls this spiritual memory, and she sees it help unite a couple like Mildred and Joseph. Joseph agrees.
As a person that I humbly present faith, it's strengthening to me, and I think probably it's contagious for her to hear the music, hear the prayers, hear the pastor's message.
The part of the brain that first gets affected by Alzheimer's disease is the part of the brain that stores new memory. The parts of the brain that store long-term memory are affected later in the disease.
Melanie Chavin is the vice president of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Illinois. She says one of the hardest things for family members of loved ones with dementia is that they don't really know if, say, visiting grandma makes a difference. Is she still there if she doesn't know who you are or can't have a conversation about today or even 5 years ago? Chavin says worship arouses what she calls overlearned memories, the Lord's Prayer or the 23rd Psalm.
So if you're a person who's worshiped your whole life, been a faithful person who went to church every Sunday, or just like to sing the hymns, then you're going to remember that stuff way into the end of the disease.
Our old
husband
ever did the 23rd Psalm. Feel free to join together with me if you remember this familiar song. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He made me
These worship services aren't just about remembering the past. They're designed to help engage residents in this present moment. So in addition to traditional hymns and scripture, Chaplain Janet Aldrich works to provoke the other senses. That's why she's tied red streamers to a fan for this Pentecost service, a symbol of the presence of the Holy Spirit. She also hands out red carnations. And if you've ever smelled a snuffed-out church candle, you can imagine why she sought special permission to use real fire.
There's just a treasure house of embedded spiritual memory that has to be tapped. And, you know, it's exciting when you realize that whatever I have done in the design of the service has worked at least with someone.
Hi there.
Hello.
Just put that thing down in front of you.
After the worship service, Mildred and Joseph make their way to the dining room. Joseph still lives at home, but never misses supper here with Mildred. They sit next to each other. Joseph looks lovingly at Mildred. Mildred holds the red carnation from the Pentecost service. Chaplain Aldrich and I join them.
Did you enjoy the worship service?
Of course.
Do you always come to the worship service?
This is the first one I've been to because I live very close by, so I have to be careful where I go. But I liked it.
This isn't Mildred's first time. She's lived here for 2 years. But Joseph and Chaplain Aldrich have learned that correcting Mildred only makes her anxious. comforting Mildred is a matter of pastoral care. Still, this isn't a one-way street. There's something Mildred offers to Joseph as well.
When I come here to be with her and try to comfort her, an amazing peace and serenity comes over me, and I feel healthier.
Joseph says that serenity is more than physical, mental, or emotional. It's a deeply spiritual peace and a form of connection, soul to soul. He never imagined making with his wife at this stage in her dementia and in their life together. I'm Jason DeRose, Chicago Public Radio.
So I thought I might put this piece in the collection of stories about character. But then I thought, this is a good story about conflict that isn't... There's no way to resolve this. It is person versus self. It is person versus nature. I feel like there's every form of conflict going on in here, except the normal form that we think about, which is two hostile forces, like two hostile people, going at each other. What worked in the story for you? Or what didn't work?
I really appreciated how the husband said he was able to have and find a new level of relationship with his wife because I'm an administrator at a dementia facility. And what I see all the time is people who are grieving the loss of life they hope they would have, and just really having a hard time relating to that person because they're grieving so badly. And you know, we all say till death do us part in our vows, and it's so hard to turn your loved one over to a facility. So I really like that aspect.
Yeah, I love that the details I was able to include. Like, they eat dinner together every single day, which I think is just wonderful.
Exactly the story of my mom and dad. So she passed away about 3 years ago of Alzheimer's. And I guess what I want to say is thank you.
You're welcome.
Because you captured, I think, both the emotional and conflicted feelings that people feel in that situation.
Too. I did this for one of those stories. I'm aware of, you know, that I'm listening to it with my, you know, Lutheran pastor ears, and but remembering that most of the people that listen to NPR are not churchgoers, are secular people. And so, you know, I really appreciated this as, you know, as a pastor, as a daughter, as a at so many levels, but. Then I was thinking, you know, if I heard this as a secular person, I would have an appreciation also, I think, for spiritual and pastoral care that is exercised by, you know, by people of faith. And so I don't hear stuff like that on the radio very often, where it really portrays the
the pastoral care of a community and of this couple in a way that really lifts up the role of ministry. So I thought that was really cool.
Thank you. Thank you. Sometimes when I... If I could have added a minute to this piece, as with every piece that I rethink, I would have probably wanted to say, I mean, I think the whole piece is a piece about what pastoral care is, but there's a moment when I say, you know, correcting someone with dementia actually creates more anxiety, comforting her is a matter of pastoral care. I would have loved to go into that a little bit more and done a little bit of theories of pastoral care. I worry that it would have broken the sort of the narrative, but that is, I think, a really interesting idea to explore more of. Somebody else? Yes? Okay.
I appreciated the education, and because, you know, I too, as a pastor, people are like, I don't want to go visit my mom anymore. She doesn't know I'm there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh yeah, they know you. They know your presence as a loving person coming to them. And they'll say, I remind you, you remind me of my son. You know? Mm. And that whole piece of awakening, of bringing back those old memories and retelling them, that liturgy does.
Right. I mean, one thing that was important to me in this piece was to not be particularly woo-woo spirituality about it. So I wanted people to understand, like, there is brain science to what's going on here. This is not magic. It's... if you overlearn something or repeat something your whole life, 23rd Psalm, the Lord's Prayer, certain hymns, you will know that deeper into dementia. Like, that is brain science. You could tell this whole story about, you know, nursery rhymes, but it wouldn't have been as, you know, wonderful to hear as so I'm glad that we were able to, you know, inject a little bit of brain science into the piece to help people understand that, you know, I'm not trying to be too mean by saying something like spiritual woo-woo, but like there are good reasons that this works. There are also, though, church is one of those places where people come together around a ritual that they repeat for 60, 70, you know, 80 years of their life. And so that is one of the ways that people will be able to continue to relate to a community even when they have dementia.
But that's part of the power, because if you are faithful like that, then that faithfulness produces, even in your most dire moment, or even when you don't know who you are, God is still present, both in your mind and in your spirit.
I think that there are... So we don't go into all of the brain science in this piece, clearly, but there are forms of dementia that you don't remember the overlearned stuff from earlier. Fortunately for Mildred, this was not one of them. So I think it's probably important to know more about what kind you're dealing with at any time.
I'll be really quick.
Sure.
At least 30 years ago or more, I was visiting a pastor and was visiting Wayne in the hospital. He was in a very sterile room. Beds were situated just in the open. They had all kinds of brain monitors on him. He'd had a brain aneurysm, and he was flatlining. And the nurses asked who I was and why I wanted to be there, and they just rolled their eyes when I said, look, but it's something I do, and perhaps I'm doing it more for me. And I had a short visit with Duane, and then I prayed with him, and then at the end when I started praying the Lord's Prayer.
Wow.
Yeah. Huh. And then, as I was saying goodbye on the monitor, then it dropped and flattened it again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is a lovely, gentle piece, and I really appreciate it. A lot of things you read and hear about dementia is so frightening. Mm-hmm. What are we entering into, this deep hole? And this represented what I think you find out, that you're scared at first as you enter into that process, but it's just another part of life. It's a new phase of life, and it's surrounded by God's love and your love, and that's beautiful.
Thank you. I'm glad I was able to get that through. I'll tell a little bit of background how I found this story and why I was interested in it. So when I was in divinity school myself, I did sort of, I wasn't it wasn't CPE, but it was like CPE, where I worked in a Methodist retirement home where there was a memory care unit, and I was terrible. I'm not a pastor, thankfully, and I was terrible at working at that place. In part because my supervisor said all of my conversations had to be spiritual conversations, and she would yell at me for playing checkers with the patients whose families never visited them. But some people don't want to talk about God. Some people just would like company and to play checkers with them. And so I did this story for myself just as much as I did it for the other folks who were in the story and for listeners, because I wanted to like have a good experience talking about these issues of memory care and so forth. Because I'd had a really bad experience being told that, you know, actually yelled at in front of the person that I was playing checkers with for being not really being there as a pastor because I was doing that. So it's part of the storyteller. The storyteller's story comes out in certain ways too, in telling other people's stories. Any final questions? Yes.
May I throw one thing on the board about conflict?
Sure.
There's two things in life. One thing is here, one thing is here. This is things that matter, things that are here, are the things that you control. Here are things where we can focus life. Here's where conflict takes place on things that matter, but things we don't control. Here are things that we can control, but things that don't matter. Here's where we should be in life, but here's where things, these two areas where we have no control are things that don't matter, and that's where all the conflict in life is.
Right. Well, I hope that the stories that I try to tell, and that, you know, as far as our religion coverage at NPR goes, try to be in that area where they're worth talking about and not just worth fighting about. But at the same time, I also think that it's important to not think that everything that is in conflict needs to be resolved. I don't know that there is a way to resolve that story we just played. I don't know that there is a way to resolve the first story I played about the one member of the couple is religious and the other isn't. Well, thank you so much for coming to these. I hope that if you came to all three, I hope that they all worked well for you.